If you weren't one of the more than 1,000 listeners who gave during WFAE's recent end-of-year membership campaign, we're looking at you. Public Radio Nerd t-shirts and coffee mugs are still available for a donation to Charlotte's NPR News Source. Call 704-549-9000 or go to WFAE.org. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, Mecklenburg County passes next year's budget and includes a tax increase. American Airlines hits turbulence on the ground.
Very annoyed and angry with American.
Every time we think we're getting out of here, we got canceled.
Unreal, aggravating, and there's nothing we can do.
A computer glitch grounds thousands of flights and hundreds of passengers for days at our airport and airports around the country. President Trump issues an order separating migrant children from their parents and quickly reverses that decision, but not before other lawmakers, including those from North Carolina, speak out in protest. And those hoping the state would find a way to cancel or amend the I-77 toll road contract are disappointed. Again, our roundtable of reporters is set to detail those and other stories this hour, and those reporters include David Borax from WFAE News. Welcome back.
Hello, Mike.
Katie Peralta is here from the pages of the Charlotte Observer. She leapt off the page to be here this morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome. Sean Flynn is managing editor of Spectrum News Charlotte. Thank you for joining us.
Glad to be here.
And Glenn Birkins is back. He's the editor and publisher of Q City Metro.
Good morning.
Good morning. We're all on the radio. If that's not enough for you, we're also on Facebook Live this morning. Mecklenburg County passed the budget for the next fiscal year, and for the first time in 5 years, there will be a tax increase, a small one, 0.75 cents. This follows an announced property tax increase by the city. County Commission voted 6-3 on this, with Republican members voting no, and that includes Matthew Ridenour.
We've already been told that the average home price is going to increase by about 30 to 35% next year. So I think that having a tax increase prior to a revaluation is just a bad idea.
So GOP Commissioner Bill James said something similar in the weeks leading up to that vote. But when they conduct revaluations, they usually adjust, do they not, so that it's revenue neutral, so that if your property goes up in value, they lower your taxes, so it's the same.
Yeah, right? That's exactly right, Mike. They do what they say is revenue neutral, where they'll bring the property tax rate down because all the property tax rate normally goes up, the percentages. So they say it's going to be revenue neutral, but for a good portion of the population, your effective rate, how much you pay, is going to go up, and for some areas, it's going to go up substantially.
Okay. So you're saying that it's not going to be revenue neutral this time. Is that because of the city, or is that because of the county, 0.75 cents?
No, again, what they do is they try to balance it. So they basically revalue everybody's property, and then they add up all the numbers, and they say, okay, instead of 82.63 cents per $100 value,
right.
To get that number exactly right, we can now lower it to 75 cents. But, you know, give us a couple extra $1 million, so we'll leave it at 70 cents. It's every 8 years they have to do this revaluation, and it seems like they never get it actually revenue neutral. They give themselves a little bump room. But it really hurts those areas that have seen a lot of growth.
So this will add about $18.75 more a year on taxes on a $250,000 home. So you have to do the math to figure out what your home will do. Is this part of the $44 tax increase that we talked about a week or two ago with regard to the city's tax hike? Was the county tax hike rolled
into that? Add the two together, you get $44. So in the city's case, it's a penny, and it's $25 on a $250,000 house. Add that to the $18.75 on a $250,000 house, and you end up with $44. And again, it's going to be different depending on the value of your house.
Okay, and there are fees going up too.
Does not include fees, depending on where you are. If you're in the city, you've got trash collection fees going up and that sort of thing.
So what are we getting for all this money? What are we getting for our money here? CMS will have their county funding increased by $31.1 million, which is about $9 million or $8 million less than I think they asked for. I think they asked for $40 million. There are $11.8 million set aside for locally funded school employees and $7 million for teacher salary supplements. They always ask for more than they're going to get at CMS. Everybody does.
That's right.
How negotiations work. So is this substantially less, or is it on average, is it on par with what normally happens?
I think they did pretty well this year. They asked for $41 million. They got $31 million. And That's basically most of the county increase overall. I think the overall increase was $33 million. So I think CMS did pretty well. They didn't get everything they asked for, but they did get some salary increases. There's more for school security and those sort of things. You know, our school system has been coping with growth in Charlotte for years. There's always going to be a need for more.
And there's the county computers that were hacked. More is going to go into making those secure. I think you mentioned, is it called Universal Pre-K or something like that?
I didn't mention it, but I was about to mention it. The budget funds new pre-K or pre-kindergarten classrooms for 600 students to the tune of $9 million. And this is a new push, relatively new push by CMS. And also Democratic Commissioner George Dunlap took issue with the Republicans' claim that the county could not afford this.
There has been an injustice done to children who have not had the opportunity to move themselves out of poverty. We have long heard justice delayed, justice denied, and we should not deny these children any longer.
So all of the GOP members on the commission voted no on this budget at large because of the tax increase. But on this particular issue, pre-K, they seem to be on board. So it wasn't a vote against pre-K. And Commissioner Vice Chair Jim Puckett believes elected officials should find a way to pay for the program, but not taxpayers. What does that mean?
I think they meant
taxpayers pay for everything.
Didn't they want to dip into their savings that they had? And there was opposition from Democrats that you can't do that on an annual basis. It's not sustainable, in other words. So they needed to raise the tax at some point in time to sustain that.
So did Jim Puckett make a proposal about how he would do it? Or did he say we should do it differently?
I don't think he had an answer.
I think he just spoke in generalities. He talked about the savings account, if you will. And I think he talked about finding other areas to cut. But I thought Trevor Fuller, you know, he nailed it. You can't raid your piggy bank but once. If this is going to be an ongoing program, excuse me, it needs to have some kind of ongoing funding.
Okay. The budget contains about $2 million to fund the property revaluation process. I mean, it costs $2 million to revalue the property, and they do it, I think you said, every 8 years or 7 years. I think it was seven, actually.
Eight years.
Is it 8 years? They want to reduce it now. They want to do it every 4 years.
Yeah, because if every 8 years, you're going to have some people who are left with that big sticker shock. You heard Commissioner Ridenour talk about how some people are going to see their property tax bills go up 30-40%. So because the last time they revalued again was 8 years ago. If you do that every four years, their property taxes go up, you know, let's say 15-20% as opposed to that.
I think really 4 years is closer to a best practice. The county has waited the maximum amount of time allowed by law for the last couple of revaluations. And imagine, you know, your property is worth a certain amount this year. In 8 years, it's going to be worth a lot more the way Charlotte has grown and real estate prices has gone up. And that does create that situation where people get hit with this new bill that is shockingly large.
I remember back in 2010, they were putting a lot of additional money forward so they could automate the system so that they could actually revalue every 2 years.
Wow.
Obviously, that didn't happen because they waited the maximum 8 years to do it, but they are really trying to get that back.
So the county tax raise is 0.75 cents. That's less than the city increase is going to be. Is that normal? Is that the way it usually is? Does the county usually ask for a smaller tax increase, or do we know? And I ask because Marcus Jones, who is the city manager, told us on this program that the tax increase that they're putting forth this year at the city level should sustain the city for years to come. I've forgotten the reasoning behind this, but he said they will not need to do this again for a very long time. Hope he's right. But
so do I.
If the county has to keep doing it, is it going to be less? Is it going to be 0.75 cents, or is it going to be 2 cents, or do we know?
Well, I think just historically, in the 15 years I've been here, you never see the county and the city do a property tax rate hike the same year. So I think that's a little bit differently. Normally, the tax rate goes up in off-year elections. So it's not a city council election term this year. So it's more likely that the city would have raised taxes this year. Mecklenburg County is in an election cycle, so that's a little bit probably more unusual.
And we're seeing tax increases this year, and we're seeing an argument for why. And, you know, whenever you do this, if you're an elected official, you want to show people what they're getting for it. And we've talked about the schools. Glenn mentioned that there's like $6 million in there for computer security upgrades so we can avoid another hacking situation like happened last December. There's more money in here for another big story we've been following, the health department. Remember, there's been all kinds of troubles at the health department. We have new leadership, and there's a couple of million dollars in there for a transition there as they try to professionalize and improve operations. There is money for the revaluation. So I think the county leaders think that they've got a list of things. Like, what are you getting for your extra money? And likewise with the city. I mean, we've talked about that in previous shows, but raises for police and fire and other things like that.
Yeah, it's purely anecdotal, but people seem to be very much in favor of teacher pay raises. So even if their tax dollars are going for that, they don't seem to be very upset by that.
And I think that's the way they've pitched this, is we're doing this for the schools. And it's in a year when we've seen protests at the legislature and that sort of thing. So there's also money in there for average 3.1% raises for county employees overall. So
okay. It was a breakneck week in Washington. It's kind of been that way for about a year and a half. President Trump signed an executive order mandating the separation of migrant children from their parents if their parents came here illegally. This, of course, has resulted in kids being placed in cages in various places around the country, and we don't even know where all of those places are, which I find incredibly, I don't even know the word for that, to be honest with you. The Washington Post is now asking for anecdotal information from people to plot places on the map around the country where these children might be. And there seems to be some discrepancy about how we might reunite these kids with their parents, because there is no paperwork, and some of these kids are infants. Anyway, as you might imagine, if you've actually been following the news, this is called a stir. This has caused a stir, and major Trump supporters, including Franklin Graham, opposed the policy. Congressional candidate Mark Harris, also a supporter of the president, told WFAE that children must not be separated from their parents. This has been going on since April. We just found out about it. Why?
I don't know if we just found out about it or for whatever reason it just kind of gained traction. I think we've known for several weeks now that this would happen. But I think your basic point is correct, that for some reason this just suddenly kind of exploded onto the scene.
There were also a lot of images that came out this week. Government released photos, and I think it was ProPublica that released audio of children crying and wailing, missing their parents. And some of those images, it sounds like, ultimately might have been what helped move Trump in some direction. We know that he responds to visual cues, and I think that he cited like Melania, his wife, and his daughter as reasons for, you know, kind of having a change of heart, I guess you would call it.
Well, speaking of Melania and visual cues, the coat that she wore to one of those shelters yesterday that said "I don't care, do you?" on the back of it. By the way, it was a $39 coat. It's the least expensive piece of clothing she's worn since she's been in the White House. I read this morning. Why would you do that? I mean, was she making a statement or is she tone deaf?
Well, her spokeswoman said that, you know, the media ought not to look too far into the message. There's no hidden.
Really?
There's no hidden message. Trump tweeted soon thereafter that it was about the fake news media. She's realized how dishonest they are, et cetera. So not really sure what to take away from that. I think a lot of people have some questions. And at the very least, as someone so visible, you kind of think that people might look into that. So,
okay. Well, we'll talk some more about this because I want to find out what other local politicians and other politicians around the country have been saying about this, because they did move the needle with their being upset with this policy. David Borax is here, Katie Peralta from the Charlotte Observer, Sean Flynn from Spectrum News Charlotte, Glenn Brookins from QCityMetro.com, and we will continue in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. After you catch up on this week's news, download the latest episode of WFAE's investigative podcast, She Says. WFAE's Sarah D'Elia has been following a sexual assault victim's journey through the criminal justice system. And in this latest episode, the victim worries police are ignoring her case. Download episode 4, Whiplash, and subscribe to the series wherever you get your podcasts. And for more on the series, go to WFAE.org/She Says. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. David Borax is here from our newsroom at WFAE. Katie Peralta from The Observer. Sean Flynn from Spectrum News. Those of you who have Spectrum cable can see Sean on a regular basis. And Glenn Birkins, editor-publisher of QCityMetro.com. We're talking about the Trump reversal on family separation, which was brought about by a lot of, well, brought about by politics and even Republicans who don't break ranks with the president on a normal basis, broke ranks with Mr. Trump on this. I mentioned Mark Harris, who was running for Congress in the 9th Congressional District here. Tom Tillis had something to say about this. Were these remarks what pushed the needle, or was it public protest that pushed the needle,
or just bad optics that pushed the needle? I think it was a combination of all the above. You had every living first lady who came out against this policy. You had church leaders who came out against this policy. All living first ladies, including the president's own wife, at least verbally, came out against it. I think it had to be a combination of all of this. This was really an issue that the president needed to make go away really quickly, and he did what he had to do.
Well, whose idea was it? Stephen Miller?
I don't know.
Or the president's?
I'm not sure.
I can't talk about this. I really can't talk about this.
I think that.
But when you have Republicans like Tom Tillis, Patrick McHenry, Ralph Norman in South Carolina, Richard Burr, saying that the idea of separating children from their parents is a bad idea and in some cases immoral, who thought it was a good idea?
I mean, this is the modus operandi of the administration. They come up with an idea, they look at the politics of it, and this is something that I think maybe played well to the base of the Trump administration. And so somebody thought that was a good idea. They started the ball rolling on it. I don't think there was ever any situation where they sat down and looked out and said, what are the repercussions going to be? What
Why
is
not?
The feedback going to be?
Why not? That's their job.
It is their job, but that's not the way they do things. And it may be compounded by the fact that there are disagreements within this administration over many of these quick policy moves. And something that looks good for a Trump presidential campaign maybe is not so good for the country.
And maybe I'm a bit cynical, but when you've gotten away with so much, why not believe you can get away with
Let's be cynical here for a second, because we don't know where all of these child detention centers are. We know that it takes some planning, it would seem to me, to manufacture the tents that they're putting some of these people in, and to take over facilities and build cages in them. That takes some time, some planning, and certainly some money over time to make that happen. Recently, reporters, at least from CBS, were granted access to one of those facilities in Texas. They were told they could go in, but they couldn't take their cameras, and they were provided video by the government of what was going on inside. I find that very curious.
What is this, Russia? Official word.
I find it very curious. I find it un-American, actually.
I read somewhere that some of the contracts to build these facilities have gone to former military people, to friends of the administration. I don't know if it was in the Times or the Post, but they were able to track some of the money that went into building these facilities fairly quickly, some of them.
You know, they're also it's not clear that they're fully organized with this policy that they started. There was something on NPR where they interviewed a refugee or an assistance worker who's working with these folks. And she said, well, we think we know where all the parents are of these kids in this one particular facility, but they don't know where all of them are. And that raises the question, will they be able to reunite these families easily? And a lot of times these kids maybe are too young. They don't even know their own last name.
Well, some of them are infants.
Right.
And they don't have paperwork on these kids, evidently. It's shocking.
It's not clear. We don't know. We haven't been able to go and investigate as reporters what's going on at these places.
From a media point of view, these are taxpayer-funded facilities. Why can't you take a camera inside? Do they have a right to tell you you can't take a camera inside?
There was they have the right to say whatever they want. We have the right to ask. I think we do have a right to access these. There was a case this week where a group of mayors from around the country were trying to go into one of these facilities, and they showed up and they were denied access. And they were told you have to apply and it'll take 2 weeks to get any permission.
Again, optics. There may be nothing wrong inside those facilities, aside from the fact that you have children who are separated from their parents lying on mattresses and cages. Aside from that, it's probably hunky-dory. But why don't they understand that that raises all kinds of
questions? It raises the big question. What do they have to hide? And we don't know. And, you know, we're, as reporters, it's our job to keep pushing and trying to get those permissions and try and get in there. And we have a few cases. You know, Katie, you mentioned the ProPublica has done a lot of reporting on this. There's that tape with the kids crying and all of that. That's all we have right now. You would think that somebody in the administration would say, look, here's what we're seeing out there. We need to make this go away somehow. And I think providing government-taken videotape is not the answer. You got to let, you know, respectable news media in there who can do this and let people know what's going on.
There is no respectable news media in the eyes of this administration.
I think there's also
enemy of the people.
Going back to the optics thing, I think that if there's anything that we've learned over the last 18 months, it's that this administration is not terribly cognizant of the optics of a situation, nor are they always consistent on the messaging as far as how they handle a certain policy change, crisis, et cetera. We've seen the administration change their tone several times over the last several weeks about how this can be changed, if they can change it, whether or not it's Congress's role, if it's their role to play. So there's really kind of a back and forth. It's really confusing as to where exactly they stand.
Well, the facilities for children, at least, are scattered all over the country. They're in Texas and they're in California. They're in Washington State. They're in New York State. They're up in the middle part of the country.
Arkansas.
Are there any here? Do we know? Because we don't know where they all are. Do we know if there are any in North or South Carolina?
Do not know.
I don't know.
We've done a lot of looking around. We haven't found anything.
And what happened before this policy went into place? Because the president spent the whole week blaming the Democrats on this, on their intransigence on immigration reform, until he stopped making that statement, and then said we couldn't change the policy, but then they did change the policy, and the policies, there's a question about whether or not not separating these kids is even legal, because you can't put kids in jail with their parents if they're in jail. So how did this work?
Which means you
before?
Have to put them in something other than a jail, another kind of a housing situation,
is that
temporary,
how it
whatever.
Before?
That's how it had been working. There were cases in the past under the Obama administration where families were separated for a time. There was a court case that said you can't put kids in jail with their parent. I mean, you know, that certainly is a grain of truth to what the Trump administration is saying here. But the change in policy really was Trump saying we're going to grab everybody at the border and we're going to separate the families. That was the change in policy.
So how much of this is a desire to push the envelope, to make Congress do something versus just being mean? Is this the first step in a grand negotiating scheme to make the Congress realize if you don't do something, I'm going to do something and it's not going to be nice?
I think you have to at least consider that. When you look at what happened in North Korea, for example, the Trump administration really manufactured a crisis and then kind of backed away from it. And the next thing you know, we're having a summit with North Korea. That strategy does work, and I think and it's something that I've thought about. Is there a bigger plan here? Is he creating a crisis in order to force Congress to finally do something, whether it's to build the wall or whatever?
Okay, are they going to move? Do you think this will make the move? I mean, this is a very difficult situation, particularly on the Republican side of the aisle, where you have two constituencies that you have to please or placate, and I'm not sure that can be done because they're really on opposite sides of the tentpole.
I'm not sure it can be done, especially in an election year. it just looks nearly impossible. Even in past years, we've had a number of proposals to have some type of comprehensive immigration reform.
Yeah.
Nothing ever came of it.
Well, there have been seven bills, I'm told, that have been introduced in Congress this week that deal with this because of this crisis. And one was to have gone to a vote in the House yesterday. They postponed it because they don't vote in the House anymore unless they know they can pass the bill. And they didn't have the votes yesterday. So now they're going to vote on it today, that would mandate Homeland Security to keep families together while they await legal hearings, and would also grant DACA recipients, the Dreamers, a path to citizenship. This seems like a non-starter to me, is it?
I believe it is, especially if you look at the president's Twitter account this morning, where he already tweeted out Republicans should stop, quote, wasting their time on immigration until after we elect more senators and congressmen and women in November. Dems are just playing games, have no intention of doing anything to solve the decades-old problem. So it appears with the president already telling some of the conservative members of his base not to even move forward with this, it might be dead before it even gets to the floor.
And his base loves this because this is exactly what he campaigned on. And in fact, he's coming to South Carolina. The president's coming to South Carolina next week to campaign for one of the candidates on the he's now the Republican candidate for governor. He won the primary, I think. Did he win the primary?
This is a runoff.
This is a runoff between Governor Henry McMaster and John Warren. Who's a businessman from South Carolina.
He's coming to campaign for
McMaster, who he has endorsed a month ago, and he's been tweeting almost every day now saying what a great guy McMaster is. We don't have the details yet, but it'll be somewhere probably in Columbia on Monday. Vice President Pence will also be campaigning for McMaster on Saturday somewhere in South Carolina. I haven't heard yet. Have you, Sean?
I believe they're also making a stop in Myrtle Beach as well.
Okay. So the full court press is on.
Yes, and the president has already tweeted out this morning his support for Governor McMaster.
Okay. Well, in Charlotte, beginning last Thursday, the airport was a nightmare, evidently, because of a glitch that involved PSA, which is this wholly owned subsidiary of American Airlines. It's the regional carrier that runs the smaller jets to puddle-jumping cities to the hub here in Charlotte. And it grounded 2,700 flights around the country, 2,000 of them in Charlotte, with hundreds of passengers being stranded here. For most of the weekend, they couldn't get out of the airport. They ran out of hotel rooms, evidently. They ran out of Ubers. They couldn't book them on other flights. We did a part of a program on this yesterday. Do they yet know what went wrong? Because this was a computer glitch that involved the scheduling of flight crews and airplanes, not passengers.
Well, they did say it's not a hacking incident. So at least that's what they tell us. They said it is a hardware issue that created the glitch, and it just took several days to figure it out.
I think the other side of the coin here is that I think I read this in The Observer. One of the analysts who was looking at this said it doesn't look like they had any kind of a backup. So when you've got a critical system that schedules your pilots and flight attendants, and you don't have a backup, this is a disaster waiting to happen. Well, we're seeing it this week.
As we were doing this program yesterday, we got an email from a listener who we couldn't get to because we ran out of time, but they wanted to know why they couldn't have just broken out an Excel spreadsheet and done the scheduling like they did back in the 70s.
Great question.
I'm not sure it's possible anymore. We have so many more airplanes and so many more flights. I don't think you could do that manually, could you?
They have to have somebody who can do that.
Really?
I mean, just...
A bunch of people in a conference room moving pieces around.
So yesterday on this program, we talked to airline analyst Seth Kaplan about the increasing number of troubles that airlines have been experiencing with technology. This is not something new. And he said, essentially, this has been going on for a long time, and it's going to continue to go on. He said, because they're working with a mix of old and new technology, and when something goes wrong, it is almost impossible to ferret out the problem.
On one hand, when you kind of look at the headline operational statistics of these airlines, on a day-to-day basis, they tend to actually be more reliable than they used to be, thanks partly to automation, right? I mean, the computers do some good things. That's why they're there. But then when things go wrong, they go really wrong. And decades ago, you couldn't have had one glitch that would have caused something like this.
And part of that's because they have old systems, they have new systems, they have airlines that have merged with other airlines, and the computer systems barely speak to each other. And because they're not a bank and they're not a small business and they are an airline and they have security concerns, they can't just go out to Joe Schmo's cloud service and have their computers fixed. They have to have it done with security precautions in mind. Did they try to book these passengers on other flights, or is that something that's gone by the wayside? In other words, did American try to book people on Delta, on Southwest, on other airlines that might fly here?
I believe they did, but the problem is PSA runs runs a good portion of the flights out of Charlotte Douglas.
12%.
12%. So when you're trying to rebook 12% of your flights on the rest of the airlines, there's just not enough capacity.
There's nothing else out there
to do that. And So they were just stuck between a rock and a hard place when it comes to that. But you add continued problems because people. I heard from passenger after passenger, "Hey, tomorrow here we got a flight for you." They get to the airport after finding their own hotel room a lot of occasions, mm-hmm. and they're told, "Oh no, your flight's not happening today." And we interviewed one guy who was basically told that five consecutive days in a row. I mean, I don't know where he was going, but he potentially could have walked there faster. But it was a debacle to a whole different degree. I'm actually surprised we didn't hear from from the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department of more problems. They had to arrest one woman who a criminal citation who broke a window. I'm actually surprised we didn't hear more of that. We only heard two of occasions, but I mean, could you just imagine being there? I get upset if my flight's delayed an hour or two. I can't imagine being stuck there for five days.
One of the people that we talked to at WFAE, one of the passengers, said that she was through with American. But the problem with that is there have been so many airline mergers, and if you're flying from Charlotte, that's pretty much your choice.
It's the only game in town, Mike.
So we also had passenger rights advocate Charlie Leoka on the program yesterday. He advocates stiffer penalties and payouts to passengers when these things happen, saying that even though these glitches cost the airlines tens to hundreds of millions of dollars each time they happen, the airlines come out relatively unscathed when compared to what passengers have to endure.
Consumers are the people who bear the brunt of this. Yes, the airlines are losing tens of millions of dollars, but that's on operational sides. But the consumers are missing out on vacations, they're missing out on weddings, they're missing out on all sorts of areas that they cannot get back. It's more than money.
And part of this problem is that consumer choice has been reduced.
Absolutely. Consumers
not only just here in Charlotte, everywhere.
Everywhere. Right. Consumer choice definitely has been reduced. And we've been seeing this for a long time. This one affected American. But we've been seeing these types of problems for a long time. There was
happened
a while,
to Delta, happened to Southwest,
and they've had various causes. Some there was a while we had a spate of serious delays that they said were weather delays. Then people were sitting on tarmacs forever. There's just not a lot of accountability in this industry when it comes to the consumer.
And despite this mixture of old and new computers, the airline industry is spending $1.5 billion a month on IT personnel. So, I mean, the complexity of this is probably mind-boggling when you think about the scheduling issues of flight crews and airplanes, and then the fact that we all have apps on our phone now that interface directly with these airlines' computers to book our flights, to pick our meal, to choose our seat, to change our flight, to book our baggage, to pay for our baggage, to buy insurance. It's mind-boggling.
I'm sure, but we're only getting peanuts and Coke now. So.
That's right. Well, enjoy that while you can, because it's probably going away too. We're coming right back, and we'll be talking about, other things, including the I-77 toll lane. Stay with us. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup with David Borax from WFAE News, Katie Peralta, reporter for the Charlotte Observer, Sean Flynn, managing editor of Spectrum News, Charlotte, and Glenn Berkins, editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com. There was a glimmer of hope this week among opponents of the I-77 toll lane project over a bill that was going through the legislature that would have funded a possible buyout or changes to the project. However, it died when the House version could not be brought into line with the Senate version. What would this bill have done, David?
So there were actually two bills, one in the House, one in the Senate. Yeah. Both were coming up with a way to pay for any penalties and costs that might go with canceling or changing the contract with the private contractor called I-77 Mobility Partners. And that's the company that's building the toll lanes on I-77 north of Charlotte. They're going to operate them for 50 years. But we can expect that if the state tried to get out of that contract or change it in a big way, that the company is going to push back. So there are various estimates about how much it might cost, a couple hundred million, up to $600-something million. And so the bill in the House came up with $300 million or so. The bill in the Senate came up with $620 million. The bill in the Senate, which was the one that passed last, was going to take that money from other road projects around Mecklenburg and Iredell counties. And that did not fly in the House. The House did not go along with that. And so we're at an impasse there. The House leadership appointed a conference committee. As far as I know, the Senate has not really appointed anybody to that conference committee. And I'm told by Senator Jeff Tart, who was the sponsor of the Senate legislation, that that committee is not going to meet. So basically, this way of paying for it is dead. Now, that doesn't mean the whole thing is dead, but it means that basically the legislature has reserved for itself the right to decide what happens with this project. And the money will need to come from somewhere. The Secretary of Transportation is looking around to try and find the money from someplace. There's still a chance he could do that. But there's still also the negotiations that would need to happen, and we really don't know what's going to happen with that. So
you're telling me that this is not the last gasp of this. This is not the last hope gone away.
Well, right now, so over the springtime, a local advisory committee met with the transportation folks up in the Lake Norman area, and they agreed to sort of a compromise. Let's eliminate one of the toll lanes and turn it into a free lane. Mm-hmm. There are two toll lanes for most of the way. And then we'll keep one toll lane as a revenue source, and we'll turn over the operation of the tolls to the Department of Transportation. And so that compromise would not be as expensive as, you know, taking over the whole thing and not having any revenue and not doing toll lanes.
When we first started talking about this, when Governor McCrory was in office, we talked about it so many times, and it just seemed like there was such a push to have it done this way, to give this contract to Centra, to have no real debate about this, et cetera, that it seemed fishy. And they have done an audit on this. The state auditor reports that nothing improper was discovered about the NCDOT's $650 million contract with Centra to build those lanes or in the way the contract was awarded. Auditor Beth Wood.
We basically found that while the questions were good and on the surface it appeared that there was something wrong, that we were not able to substantiate anything that was questioned about the process.
So was this audit conducted because that's the way they always do things? They always have audits of major projects like this? Or was it conducted because somebody said, we need to look into this?
So these questions that we're talking about were coming from constituents and opponents of the toll lanes. They were coming from legislators who were being asked to vote on legislation. And so this was actually asked for by Senator Tart. And, you know, they were looking at things like you mentioned about the original contractors. So originally four companies got in and were going to bid on this. And ultimately it ended up that there was only one final bidder, and that was Centra. The auditors looked at this and they found one of the allegations was that the state paid these companies to bid. That turns out, at least according to this audit, not to be true. Nobody was given an unfair advantage over the others, according to the auditor. No state employees or contractors had conflicts of interest. I think we would find some folks among the opponents who would beg to differ with that. But basically, according to the auditor, that was clear. They reviewed the contract in depth. And this is the Local Government Commission, which looks at all debt in the state. Whenever a community or a state agency puts out debt, it's got to go through this commission. And there was an allegation that that the commission didn't even look at it, that they just rubber stamped it. And the auditor who actually sits on that commission says, no, that's not the way it happened. It did get a thorough review from the state, and we did, you know, approve it with knowing what we were voting on. And there's also allegations that Centra didn't say what its legal problems were and what its financial status was. And at least according to the auditor, in the time frame that they looked at, which is a key point here, Centra was, I think, they were truthful about what they had. Now, shortly after the contract was signed, there were some problems with a couple of toll roads in other parts of the U.S.
Operated by Centra.
Operated by Centra. They also had problems in Spain, which in Europe, which apparently was not part of what was required under the law for them to look at. So, you know, there are a lot of technical ways in which the auditor is correct, and I think there's still questions among folks who oppose the tolls.
And you mentioned Senator Jeff Tart calling for this audit. He says he still thinks, despite the audit, that the state got a bad deal. But he said, you can't be faulted for having terrible attorneys and agreeing to stupid terms and conditions. He says, we've been taken to the cleaners on this.
Quite an indictment of the previous administration under Governor McCrory, which passed this. So, you know, there, this is still going to be in the wind until it finally dies. I'm sure that the road is going to be completed this winter, and we will be riding on toll lanes, and anything that happens will happen after that.
So let's move on to something else more pleasant, gerrymandering. The question of gerrymandering finally made it to the Supreme Court this week on Monday, and they essentially punted on cases involving Wisconsin and the state of Maryland. Their decision was to send those cases back to lower courts, which means North Carolina's case may take on even more significance. What does all this mean, David? I know you've been covering this.
Right. So the rulings this week were in cases from Wisconsin and Maryland, one involving a complaint over Republicans, one involving a complaint over Democrats. We thought maybe that this would allow the court to resolve this, but in the end, they sent these both back to the lower courts on technicalities and did not rule on the main issue. Is it legal to draw boundaries that favor one party over the other? Is there anything wrong with that? So there is this North Carolina case. The congressional districts that were drawn by Republicans here in North Carolina in 2016, and that has been sort of waiting in the wings at the Supreme Court, and they actually were scheduled to meet yesterday in their weekly scheduling conference to decide whether to take that case up in the fall. We won't hear the results of that meeting until Monday, but in many ways, that case does not have the same issues as the others, and it could be a cleaner case to decide.
Yeah, and Bob Phillips, who is the executive director of Common Cause North Carolina, seemed encouraged by what happened this week.
For North Carolina, we're encouraged because certainly these technicalities have nothing to do with our case. We feel like we have a particularly strong case here, especially with sort of the smoking gun, if you will, and that is where lawmakers blatantly bragged about what they were doing when they drew these maps in February 2016, and that was admitting it was a partisan gerrymander.
In the case in Wisconsin, Democrats challenged the state legislative districts were said by, and the high court said that they had been unsuccessful in proving harm and therefore had no standing in the case. Proving harm here and intent is going to be very easy because a state senator said, we did this purposefully to favor Republicans.
That was David Lewis who made that statement after they redrew the boundaries. And at that time, you know, there's no case law that says you can't do it this way. And these challenges are new. So I think, you know, the difference with Wisconsin is that they made a statewide argument. They said, this isn't fair. And the justices basically said, show us why. And they want cases of individual voters in individual districts. In the North Carolina case, they basically do have people in every district who are making this argument. So it'll be interesting to see what they come up with.
Two more surprises locally. One, development is continuing in Charlotte. And two, developers get their way in Charlotte. That's the perception, and it proved it to be true again this time. This week it involves a taller than normal building outside the I-277 loop. City Council voted 10-1 in favor of a 20-story I'm confused whether it's an office tower or a hotel or both, but it's between 3rd and 4th Street and Baldwin Avenue and Queens Road. It's near the Cherry and Myers Park neighborhoods. Luana Mayfield was the sole no vote on council. Neighbors are not, or are the neighbors welcoming this building? Are they opposed to this building? Because it's the first tall building outside the loop except in South End.
Think NASCAR Tower in Midtown-ish, Cherry. Mm-hmm. Neighbors are very much opposed to it. Even some nearby neighborhoods like Myers Park weighing in on the growth of taller buildings outside of the 277 loop. They, you know, this went through, like you said, almost unanimously. This will more than double the amount of traffic per day in the area. So clearly there's some congestion concerns. That said, NAI Southern has the developer behind the project has agreed to a number of improvements, including, more more crosswalks, another traffic light or something like that, a way to control the traffic, the flow of traffic. They have said that they're not going to start construction until they have an anchor tenant for the building. I'm sure that will happen, that said. And the tower, like you said, will include a hotel as well. So that's kind of a, already a large tenant that'll be included in the project.
And City Council Larkin Eggleston, who I believe represents the area of town that tower will be in, says this is the future of the city to create create density along transit and prevent sprawl. This is vertical sprawl. So is this just the beginning of the spread of Uptown beyond its belt, beyond 277 Loop?
You know, sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, it might hint at things to come, and I think that that's why you're hearing kind of nearby neighborhoods voicing concern over that, because there hasn't really been much upward growth, you know, maybe five-story buildings max outside of Uptown Charlotte. So I think that the snowball effect maybe is a concern of nearby neighborhoods. You know, I think Larkin meant that it's preventing sprawl because it's, you know, you're growing up and not out. So I get what he means there. But I think that people are also thinking, well, you know, it might not always prevent the sprawl that we're talking about. We don't want to see, you know, skyscrapers next to our McMansions in Eastover.
So if you start there, you could spread it out to where the Manor Theater is and in many different directions.
The other thing is that we're running out of space within the loop,
right,
within the Uptown Loop.
Really? Have you seen this parking lot across the street?
Well, that's one of the...
It's actually on the drawing board for a project.
Yeah, we did a show on it this week, I know.
You know, parking lots have been turned into parks. They've been turned into high-rise buildings, apartments, condos, whatever. And so as this city continues to grow, it has to start looking beyond the loop. And we're starting to see that, as you mentioned, in South End, and we're going to see it in Midtown as well.
So Buckhead, here we come. Evidently, the makeup of the state legislature being dominantly Republican, the Democratic governor being Roy Cooper, he's had to use his veto pen a lot so far during his term. And this week, the legislature voted to override two of those vetoes. One dealt with judicial electoral districts. The other was dealt with the final day for voting. Why was the governor opposed to these two bills, and what will happen as the result of his vetoes being overridden, David?
Well, all of his vetoes will be overridden as long as he is governor in the current situation, so let's just take that as a given. But the first one was this bill that had to do with judicial districts in Mecklenburg and Wake counties and basically realigning those. Right now, they're elected kind of at large in the counties, and this would give them individual districts. And the argument in favor of that is that it would give people a chance to vote for somebody from their area, but the cases will be heard by people from all over the place. I think it's an attempt by Republicans to win more judicial seats, and that's why the governor opposed it.
So it's an attempt by Republicans to choose the judges who will approve their laws.
Well, maybe so. These are district court judges, basically. But yeah, it could be. I think it's just the overall push by Republicans since 2011 has been to look for ways to get more of themselves elected. So the other bill was going to eliminate the Saturday before election early voting, and that's a very popular day for voting, usually the heaviest during early voting.
And why do they want to do that?
You have to ask them that. The allegation and the reason the governor didn't like it is that it looks like it would be a way to try and reduce voting among African Americans and Democrats in general. And again, that would be a voter suppression sort of thing. You know, he didn't like that, but the legislature overruled his veto.
So Duke Energy is also asking for a rate increase. In North Carolina, Attorney General Josh Stein says that that proposed settlement that would allow Duke Energy to begin charging customers for electric grid improvements is unfair to ratepayers. Is he saying that ratepayers shouldn't be footing the bill for this, but shareholders should be?
That's what he's saying. He's also saying that this should be part of the regular rate-making process, and if Duke wants to do this, they should ask for it the way they ask for all their improvements. This would be an extra charge on your bill that would be paying for this. And, you know, he says it would add another 6%.
Yes.
So we've got this rate increase that they're up for, which is about, right now in our part of the state, 10%. This would be on top of that. And so he says, let's put it through a normal rate-making process and make Duke prove that all of these are needed. Duke was sort of asking for a blank check here to do all these improvements, about $7.8 billion over the next 10 years. They've agreed right now with some of the groups that oppose it to limit that to 3 years and come back and ask again for permission in the future. We're waiting possibly as early as today for a decision from the Utilities Commission on that and the wider issue of the 10% increase.
Okay. You have the last word, David Borax from WFA News. I know these people around the table are jealous of that, so... Don't hold it over their heads. Katie Peralta, reporter for the Charlotte Observer, has been with us this hour. Sean Flynn, managing editor of Spectrum News Charlotte, and Glenn Perkins, editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com. Thank you all for the hour.